Tonight on KUMD, we bring you a 2016 Allworth International Lecture titled The Brexit Revolutions, presented November 9th at UMD by Dr. William Henderson, Allworth Institute International Associate and former director. Here now is Dr. Henderson.
I'd just like to say thank you yet again to the board of the Allworth Institute, to Cindy Christian, for inviting me on what has become an annual visit to Duluth, Minnesota. And I'd like to thank the Minnesotan gods for creating such a wonderful weather for me. I think I have to acknowledge, you know, the Thunderbirds and what have you that have produced this really wonderful weather. I was joking with Cindy about the title for tonight. I started calling it the Brexit Revolution, and then I thought there's much more going on than just one kind of event in the United Kingdom, so I called it the Brexit Revolutions. But having lived with this and having been looking at the press and the political writings and so on, I discovered I was getting kind of tired of this. We're going to live with this for another 2, maybe 3 years, this process of withdrawing. So I said to Cindy, maybe I should have called it Brexit, bloody Brexit. Only the word I had in mind was not bloody. The background is unease in the Conservative Party in particular with the direction of the European Union. And you could say that the history of the Conservative Party ever since it joined is a little footnote about unease with its relationship with the European Union. But what I would like to do is just show you a sample of the sort of writing that was going around as the vote was approaching. And this is from a political journal called The Spectator, which is a quality journal. It's more on the right than on the left, but it does share, it often opens its pages to writings from the left. This, you can see, is from the right. It says, the EU now resembles nothing so much as the Habsburg Empire in its dying days. A bloated bureaucracy that has outgrown its usefulness, a parliament with no democratic legitimacy, countries on its periphery pitched into poverty. The EU's hunger for power has been matched only by its incompetence. So that is the kind of diet of information produced by and consumed by those members of the Conservative Party who are opposed to the European Union. The other thing that happened was in the last government, the coalition government, Cameron had a slim majority. He had a competition from UKIP, which is the United Kingdom Independence Party, which is to the right of the Conservative Party and which was drawing people away from the Conservative Party, both in the constituencies and potentially in the country. And there was popular unease with the level of inward migration and its perceived impact on blue-collar wages. So there was all sorts of things going on. Cameron's decision in 2013 was to renegotiate, see if he could find a deal with the European Union that would cut down the rate of migration. The idea of the European Union is founded on the freedom of trade, the freedom of capital movements, and the freedom of movements of people. And but it was never envisaged, at least in the founding days of the organisation, that there would be mass migration. That was not envisaged. And this mass migration was somewhat unpopular in parts of the United Kingdom. If you imagine that the figures for inward migration, net migration, is something around 350,000 a year, and if you plug that into a society that is already finding it difficult to provide, for example, adequate housing, then the implication is that every 3 years you should be building a new city of 1 million people. Now, it's obviously true that those waves would not continue, but what would happen with new entrance to the European Union, you would have the influx again, largely because the United Kingdom was the only society, the only economy in the European Union that was consistently growing at reasonable rates. Cameron kicked the decision. Oh, I just want to say that this idea of holding a referendum on European issues was not a new one. In 1975, Harold Wilson held a referendum. He tried to get a deal from Europe. It was clear to the Europeans that he was not going to leave, or he was not going to upset the apple cart, and he didn't gain any concessions, but he did win the referendum issue. The person who sorted out the financial problem was Margaret Thatcher. So it was Thatcher that took up the issues. But David Cameron kicked to the idea of having a referendum to deal with UKIP, to deal with the right wing of his own party. He kicked it into the new Parliament. But what happened thereafter was the unforeseen scale of the Greek debt crisis and the surge of Syrian migration. What Cameron got from the European Union, I would describe as a handful of air, since there was no legal commitment to keeping the agreements that had been made, or what the press called a wafer-thin deal. But this is the deal that he had to put to the country. I've left on the table there for anybody who is interested, although I'll collect them up at the end, the kind of literature which was delivered through the doors by the government, by the official Leave campaign and the official Remain campaign on the kind of issues that leaving the European Union or staying in the European Union might involve. The background to the result, first of all, the question was very simple. Do you want to stay in the EU or leave? And that forces you immediately into a binary world. You do this or you do that. Whereas I personally would have preferred something that said, you know, do you think the European Union needs fundamental reform? Or something along those lines, which would still give the capacity to act. Another thing that I'd like to say about referenda or referendums is that I used to think they were a good thing, that it was a form of direct democracy. Having observed the Scottish referendum and having at least experienced this one, I feel that the question and the debate morphs into something slightly different. The question about the independence of Scotland actually became like a surrogate general election, it was a criticism of the austerity packages that were being applied by the coalition government, and this morphed into a question almost entirely, in the end, about migration. The Cameron Osborne strategy, and Osborne warned Cameron that this was not a good strategy, was a negative one. If we leave, there'll be a disaster, you know, the pound will collapse, the economy will crumple, you'll all be out of work. That kind of presentation, not one selling the positive virtues of the European Union. In fact, nobody actually talked very much about other aspects of the European Union at all, and it would be wrong to suggest that the European Union has, it may have failed in economic terms in some respects, but it would be wrong to say that it has failed in other respects, if you think of the way in which resources have been directed into Eastern Europe. That can only be a good thing for European unity and so on. I'm trying to use the term European Union. I am trying to avoid Europe, because Europe is bigger than the European Union. It includes Russia, for example, and Norway, and so on. So but I will lapse like everybody else into talking about the European Union. The Leave campaign, the official Leave campaign, was based on simplification, on exploiting fears about migration, and promoting an outward strategy, a strategy which said that the world is bigger than the European Union. You know, there's a whole world out there, including China and India and really dynamic economies, whereas, of course, the European Union at the moment is flaccid economies, and its share in world output is actually probably declining. I want to just say about the word Brexit. You've probably, well, you must have come across it, otherwise you wouldn't be here tonight. But this appeared in around about 2012, and I meant to check before I came whether Grexit was before that or after that. It's probably after it, but I'm not really sure. And this became the slogan for the Out campaign, and the interesting thing is that the Remain campaign didn't have a slogan as effective as Brexit. And it generated, it and has generated and continues to generate a whole vocabulary. Brexit, Brexiteers, the people who support Brexit, debated in the Financial Times as to whether they should be called Brexiters or Brexiteers, but Brexiteers, Brexiteers won the day. And then you get Breality. You Brexiteers better face up to reality, Breality. And I even heard it used on a television program last night for Michigan, one of the Brexit states. I just would remind you that the official Leave campaign was cross-party. It was not a, it wasn't a, you know, conservatives versus conservatives, it was cross-party. My own, at the time, local MP, a member of the Labour Party, was a leading member of the Brexit, of the Out group. So that was cross-party. What then happened was that passions became high and technical understanding was nowhere. I think you've got to understand that the European Union is a very complex place. It's a mixture of supranational elements and intergovernmental elements and a complex set of policies and so on. And most people in most countries do not actually understand how it works. So you're already dealing with a kind of universal ignorance, as it were. The Labour Party leader was lukewarm. He was officially supporting staying in, but he appeared on television and somebody said, well, how strong is your support for the European Union? He said 75%. Well, you know, that's not very good if you really are wanting to guide voters in a direction that is positive. And in the last days, there were clear signs that Inn was losing the emotional argument. I just want to say something quick about voting patterns. I cannot do the kind of sophisticated analysis I watched on the television last night with a screen and pressing upcoming counties and all of that kind of thing. I can't do that. I'll just say that roughly the vote to leave was 52%, the vote to stay was 48%. The turnout was 71.8%, which is enormously high for a British. The British are not, don't like to vote. They're not like Americans who seem to be voting the whole time. You know, there's always, vote for this and vote for that and vote for the next thing. The British attitude is, we voted for you. We put you into place. Get on with it. So just, you know, don't bother us for another 4 years or 5 years or whatever. But this is an extraordinary high turnout. And it means that the result cannot be ignored. You cannot just wish it away. There was, it true, a higher turnout by older people. London voted very high for Remain, and Scotland too, but the Scottish turnout was low, particularly low in Glasgow, for example. And areas expecting a sudden kind of migrant peak also, they voted leave. So we expect that the elder people voted leave, the people expecting a migrant peak voted leave, and young people who might have been expected to vote stay didn't turn out in the numbers that they should have done. So that's just very quickly on voting patterns. Now, I think some of you might have heard me last year on the nature of parliamentary democracy. It works in a very different way from in the United States. And I was telling my friends in Britain by email that, you know, that a president in the United States is constrained by the Constitution and constrained by what's going on in the Congress. Powerful figure, but constrained. Whereas a prime minister, as long as they can command a majority in the House of Commons, is much less constrained. They have more power and more patronage at their disposal and more ways of manipulating the situation in order to get what they want. But on the 23rd of June, and I was in Poland at the time, and somewhat embarrassed by the result. I mean, you know, there are over 1 million Poles in the United Kingdom, and it's all these Eastern Europeans that, you know, messing the place up. And that's an irony. I'm not saying they are messing the place up. I was quite embarrassed by the result. Cameron, of course, resigned, as he would have to, because he clearly lost control. But he was expected to stay on until September. And I've put there he resigned twice. He resigns at this stage, and then later, when he sees what's happening to his former policies and his former colleagues, he resigns from Parliament. So he resigns from being Prime Minister, and then, oh, horror story, he resigns from Parliament. So here we have the first kind of what I like to think of as the first stage of the revolution. The Conservative Party is ruthless in its pursuit of power. I don't know if that's true of Republicans, but Republicans and Conservatives are not quite equivalent. It's a different setup, but they are quite ruthless in the pursuit of power. And there was a whole series of Shakespearean activities, you know, betrayal, stabbing in the back, not literally, and Boris Johnson suffered very badly from that. Ha ha. And well, I was very annoyed at Boris Johnson. He is a moderate Eurosceptic, and before he committed himself to the Leave campaign, he said he was all over the place like a broken supermarket trolley. So he eventually made a decision, but afterwards, on reflection, I felt angry because there was no evidence that anybody had thought, what are the consequences of this action? I mean, what kind of no planning in place. Now, you could argue that that was the responsibility of the government. It's not the responsibility of a group that's campaigning. And there was no planning on the part of the government, except the governor of the Bank of England did put a few things in place, but not very much. So during this process of this ruthless pursuit of power, Boris Johnson was stabbed in the back by his colleague Gove. This became to be known as Brexecution, that they carried out a Brexecution on Boris. In some ways, Gove may have saved Boris's political career, because Boris was not in the position, as I told you, some of you last year. He, having been Mayor of London, he had not built up a following in the House of Commons. And you can't do anything unless you've got a following in the House of Commons, and he just simply didn't have it. And he... Anyway, the result was that Theresa May became almost... Well, she was the last candidate standing. I think that's probably the best way to put it. She became Prime Minister. There was no need to have an election within the Conservative Party. And she immediately set about forming her government. And I'll come to that in a minute, because that's the second stage in the revolution. the vote to leave the European Union reversed policy that had been in Britain since 1973. So that's a big change. And then there's a secondary change, which is there. But May had to accommodate the Brexiteers. And those people are now in cabinet, those significant leaders of the exit campaign. But they're only 7 out of 25. All the other cabinet members voted for Remain. So that's already a complex... She's already got a complex situation. And just this word reversal, the three Brexiteers... Now, you know, it's a kind of satirical thing. They're being referred to occasionally as the Three Musketeers, as a kind of parody on the story. This is Theresa May. She was a very successful Home Secretary. Home Secretary is, you know, the poisoned chalice in British political life. It's where you go to politically die the death. And she hasn't, and she didn't. I'm not saying that she was free of mistakes, but she survived two administrations, and she had a very tough reputation. And just to show you how difficult it is to be a Home Secretary, the Labour Party... in two or three governments, had six Home Secretaries in 13 years, right? They don't survive. She survived. She's tough. Okay, so we need to introduce you more seriously to Theresa May. She's got a sound reputation, and she's considered to be tough in crises. She was previously a modernising Conservative Party chairman. She refused to be called chairperson or chairwoman. And in that, I think she knows her party very well. She was just glad she was the chair of the Conservative Party. And in cabinet, in Cameron's cabinet, she had fraught relations with some of leading figures in the cabinet, such as Osborne, when she was in cabinet, and Gove. And Kenneth Clark. And she'd say to Clark, I lock them up. I catch them and lock them up. Because she was Home Secretary, he was the Minister for Justice. You let them go. So, she formed, when she was chair of the Conservative Party, Women to Win. So she is a feminist, but she's not, she doesn't believe in special treatment for women. She wants women to be the best and to perform the best, and so she identified with colleagues, women that were capable of becoming members of parliament, and worked on their capacity to be members of parliament, while at the same time changing attitudes in the Conservative Party as what constituted an MP, because what they thought an MP was a man, his wife and two children, right? David Cameron gets the praise for modernising the Conservative Party, but behind that modernisation was, in fact, Theresa May. It was Theresa May who said to the Conservative Party, "Do you know what they call you out there? They call you the nasty party. So you bet. What are you going to do about it? You better change." In the Home Office, she took on the Police Federation. She challenged them on all sorts of issues, and she took a very tough stand on immigration, but failed to achieve the numbers that she was supposed to. But the numbers weren't hers; they were David Cameron's. During the election, I'm running out of time already.
Well, you started later.
Oh, did I? Okay. She stayed out of the fray. She was on the Remain side, and she was criticised as being the submarine. You know, I don't want to do this. I'll just submerge. And she sees the Brexit result as about more than the EU. She sees it as a people's revolt, not only against the idea of mass migration from the European Union. She sees it as a judgment on the government record with respect to what the previous government was doing with respect to austerity, with this respect to its approach to the poorer end of the political spectrum. She dropped Osborne immediately, very good chancellor. He went, and she said to him, "Get to know the party if you want to be prime minister." No, no, she's not afraid to say exactly what she thinks. And she brought an end to, those of you who heard me last year, to the style of government that Cameron introduced, which was a chumocracy, a government of friends. You know, you had to have been with them in Eton or Oxford, or you had to have the right attitude and so on. The Tony Blair's government was known as sort of sofa government. You know, the cabinet didn't really properly work, and it was revealed that by a Birmingham MP who was in the cabinet then that cabinet consisted of little chats. Now, May has done away with that. She wants cabinet government the way it was. You produce a green paper with policy ideas, you refine them into a white paper, and then you take them for legislation. So she's changed that. And she's introduced, and has been very consistent about this idea of meritocracy. You're not there because you went to Eton or Harrow or one of the great English public schools, which of course means private schools. You're there because you're good at what you're likely to do. So she is a very meritocratic approach. And on herself she says, "I don't gossip about people over lunch. I don't go drinking in Parliament's bars. I do not often wear my heart on my sleeve. I just get on with the job in front of me." It doesn't sound like much fun, but but that's how she is. And here's another one. "I've always championed women in politics. We just get stuck in. Politics isn't a game. The decisions we make affect people's lives." And I think you can see in that these are very pragmatic statements. They're not ideological statements. They're very pragmatic statements. So let's have a look at other character assessments of anyone who thinks that May is the kind of politician who says something important without meaning it underestimates her, as many do. Right? So I think that she was ignored in the last cabinet, last administration. Kenneth Clark, who is a long-term opponent of her, called her in an overheard interview on television. They kept the cameras running. He knew they were running. You know, he knew what he was doing. A bloody difficult woman, right? And the Spectator said that she may well turn out to be an unexpected radical. Her constituency, whose name I've forgotten at the moment, her constituents report that she is very approachable and that she deals very effectively with the problems that they bring to her. "May contain nuts." This is the Times Leader's headline on the composition of her cabinet. So that's what... And, of course, why Boris Johnson? Considering everything, why Boris Johnson? Now, the interesting thing there is Boris Johnson ended up as Foreign Secretary in the exact post he would have had he backed David Cameron. There was a deal, and he rejected the deal. Well, of course... The answer is that she needs to buy off members of her own party. She sacked most of the main people. She needs some who have got a degree of credibility with the party and a degree of support. And Boris Johnson, for all his failings, and all his all the name calling, you know, he's a liar and so on. Boris is a satirist. All his journalism is satire. And you don't understand the things that Boris says unless you understand the context. And if you quote Boris out of context, he looks like, could he really believe that? But you've got to keep that in mind. The person who's got the Chancellor of the Exchequer is Hammond, and economically he is as dry as a stick, which means, you know, he's dry as dry. He's not going to be dishing out support for this, that, and the other needy cause. There are more women in the cabinet. There are seven women in the cabinet, which is a good number. And her Downing Street speech, when she first talked to the British public, was almost like Engels on the Manchester Poor. Almost, but not quite, because that's not the inspiration. So the second revolution. May disposed of 10 of Cameron's closest allies in cabinet over a 48-hour period. In you come. Sorry, lost your job. Out you go. There are more state school-educated cabinet appointments than in any other Conservative government. The first education secretary, the education secretary is the first one to come from a comprehensive school. There are seven women in senior posts, and it's not a government composed of the privileged few, though Oxford and Cambridge are perforce still prominent. Since we don't know in detail what she actually thinks about anything, we have to look at her advisers. Fiona Hill is a Scot. She's no fan of the Scottish National Party. She was behind the modern slavery legislation. The UK has introduced very radical legislation for the elimination of trafficking and so on. Very strong on women's equality. She was a Remainer, and she is an internationalist. But she works with her team worker, Nick Timothy, who's known as the Sage of Birmingham, if anybody, some of you have been to Birmingham. He campaigned for Leave. He wants to end the reliance on financial services. He wants to see the promotion, the active promotion of new industries through industrial policy. Industrial policy of that type hasn't been heard of for a number of years. And if you look at the structure, if any of you were at my lecture a couple of years ago about Scotland, I was arguing that there are reasons, structural reasons, why people vote the way they do. And anything in the regions, and the regions are small, mind you, are in where there are difficulties, where there's a pattern of investment that is London-oriented and not region-oriented. So he's for that. He was against China's stake in the nuclear plant, but eventually May agreed to that. He wants more social mobility, Conservatives for working people, and he is a King Edward's Grammar School boy and very much in favour of the return to very selected grammar schools in areas of working class deprivation so that good working class students can get into grammar schools and get on the ladder. Now, we'll get to Brexit. Just, you know, hang on. If you're one of, this is me speaking as Prime Minister. If you're one of those families who's just managing, if you're just managing, I want to address you directly. I know that you are working around the clock. I know that sometimes life can be a struggle. The government I lead will be driven not by the interests of the privileged few, but by yours. And I think that if you can put together the fact that the Notting Hill set has gone from government, and people who have been to grammar schools or comprehensive schools and gone then to university are now in cabinet posts, she means what she says. So she's not, in fact, a Tory. She's a Conservative. And I think there is a class difference there as well as other things. When she was faced with this problem, her immediate response was, Brexit means Brexit, which is like saying a door means a door, you know, or a cooker means a cooker, or a shoe means a shoe. This was, I think, a brilliant tautology, because nobody really knows what it means. And she wasn't going to be pushed into saying Brexit means... Now there's a demand for action, but then, in those early days, July, August, and September, it did many things. Kept the EU guessing. It reminded Remainers that the referendum is not negotiable. It is not negotiable, given the size of the voter turnout, and so on. But it kept different kinds of Brexit arguments at bay. She refused to be pushed by the other members of the European Union into triggering Article 50. Article 50 is the article which allows you to set up a legal process for leaving the European Union. And they were saying, do it now. Sorry. It's quite clearly written. It's me that initiates it, not you. She still holds some of the cards, but you've got to remember what I stressed last year for those people who were here, and what I will stress again, is that British politics are enormously fluid, and all sorts of things can upset her control of the situation. The recent High Court decision says that she needs an Act of Parliament to initiate Article 50. Well, that's all right. It only has to be one line, but it does allow for parliamentary debate. That decision has been appealed to the Supreme Court, and the court will meet either on the 6th or the 7th of December and will report on in early January as to whether that decision of the High Court is a valid decision or not. I just want to mention very briefly the tenor of the EU initial reaction. There was a lot of... the situation was mishandled. The French were all for punishing Britain, although how you can punish Britain and not punish yourself in the process, it's not entirely clear to me. Federalists have been appointed as EU negotiators, and Juncker... I'm not going to gossip about him. His reaction was, let's make Brexit a sideshow. Well, you know, you've just lost the fifth biggest economy in the world. How can you make that a sideshow? This has got serious implications. It's got implications for the European budget, for example, because Britain is a big net contributor to the European budget and doesn't get much back in terms of investment in projects in... Punishment and poaching. France is going to poach. Banks and financial houses from the City of London. Well, I'll talk about that if you want me to. But it's not as likely as it seems. And what you've really got is rules and platonic guardians versus the willingness to find a win-win Brexit. And I'm not clear how this mood in the upper levels of the EU is changing. But what I'd like to do is to show you this. There's a gap in political culture and bafflement. Here is a conservative thinker. I suppose he is a kind of philosopher of conservatism. And this is in a magazine called Standpoint. But who will hold Brussels to account? Why did it not occur to any of the five presidents or the 28 commissioners to take responsibility for the disastrous failures of recent years, culminating in the departure of the EU's second largest economy and net contributor? Why has nobody in Brussels, apart from the British commissioner, the trade commissioner, resigned or even bothered to apologise? That's an interesting question, but I think it just shows... That is a very, and I want to say English, not so much British, but that's a very English approach to political life. And it doesn't really apply. Why would Juncker think of resigning? Or why would Donald Tusk? There is just a gap of refined understanding, I think, and... Now, the reason why Theresa May said Brexit means Brexit is because there wasn't any thinking. Britain has not been responsible for trade policy since 1975. There are no... All the people that know about trade policy are in Brussels. Britain is not a member of the World Trade Organization. It's the European Union that is a member of the World Trade Organization. And so they have to look for a model. And there are various models. I'm not going to go into the details. The Norway model is you have to accept free movement, you have no say in the rules, and you pay a fee to be a member of the common market. Swiss model, the same. The Canadian model is a free trade agreement, but it took years to negotiate, and it looked as if it wasn't going to go through just at the last moment. The Turkish model is that you share the same external tariff with the EU, but you're not actually a member of the EU. And then there's the world trade model, which means you just trade at whatever whatever way that you're allowed to trade. Now, if you ask me, and I wouldn't like to be Mrs. May, really, I would go for the last one because you're not going to get the deal that you want. I do not see how you can get a deal that actually improves the situation. If you have to pay and you have to apply all the rules and you have to pay, you're going to end up paying for what? If you have a low exchange rate, you can jump, and if you have a competitive economy, you can jump over tariff wars. And in fact, I was listening to the former governor of the Bank of England, who was at one stage in my life a colleague of mine, and he was being asked, what do you feel about this dramatic drop in the exchange rate? He says, nothing to worry about. You get the exchange rate goes down, your exports become more competitive, you have a little bit of inflation, you put up interest rates, you bring down house prices. We've been trying to achieve that in policy terms for years and we've never managed it. Right? So I just thought that was interesting. Now, the view of the economic choices is with or without direct EU membership, one group say there's a 4% difference in growth as things stand. In other words, British economic growth will drop. Well, it hasn't dropped yet. And if anything, the estimates for growth for next year have gone slightly up. So we don't know when this is going to happen. Much of the gloomy warnings from Remain have not happened, and I've told you about that exchange rate consideration. It's a bit of a nuisance for me, you know, but there we are. Another view of what's going to happen is that Brexit offers the opportunity for an economic reboot. These long-standing problems, the hollowing out of manufacturing, the concomitant over-reliance on the City of London, a large and growing trade deficit, big regional differentials in productivity, have been given political manifestation by Brexit. And The Guardian is slightly left of centre, but it sees this as an opportunity. An opportunity for a complete rethink of the structure of British economic life. There was a strong link between voting patterns and the health of the local economy. So, but in order to achieve this resurgence of manufacturing and so on, you have to have a government that is prepared to accept and understand that governments can, in fact, do things. They can, in fact, promote regional investment. They can, in fact, find policies to increase productivity through investment in education and so on. But that might still be problematic, but it's clear that May's government is thinking along those terms. And then we come to the EU's own problems. Elections with the rise of the right wing, a backlash against migrant allocation. Hungary, I think, have just resolve that issue. But Poland is, it's quite ironic, really. I mean, there are 1.5 million Poles living in Britain, but they're not prepared to have 10,000 Muslims from... Italian debt is 135% of GDP, and the banking system is shaky. The oldest bank in the world, the Monte dei Paschi di Siena, its shares have been suspended on the Italian stock exchange. I've got a little bit of money in that bank. Curses. If that goes, and it's only in that position not because it's a reckless bank, but because banks need to grow out of debt, and they grow out of debt through growth in the economy as a whole. And growth in the economy as a whole is restricted because of the policy of the European Central Bank towards debt. Overall, the Eurozone is no better off economically now than it was in 2007. German growth is unremarkable, and of course there are Irish worries. The Irish economy is actually quite marginal. Most of its exports go to the United Kingdom, and then there's the problem of the north-south divide in Ireland and what's going to happen with that. There was no immediate creative response to Brexit. Juncker, according to Stiglitz, but he did say this, his line is that Europe must be unrelenting in its punishment and should offer the UK little more than is guaranteed under normal global agreements, lest others join the rush to exit. And Stiglitz says, what a response. And it's a curious response. I mean, a state is, of course, always based on a little bit of coercion, but you mean that Britain leaving is going to have a domino effect and all the way through, in which case your institutions really are in trouble. So Juncker smirked when he heard the result, and Angela Merkel was furious at him, and he was told he would not be in charge of the process of negotiation. Country views. Well, there are various country views. I'm running short of time, so I don't want to go through those, but the country views don't matter very much at the moment because the EU will negotiate as a bloc. There will be no chance for the British to divide and rule. Just a quick word on Article 50. Any member may decide to withdraw from the Union in accordance with its own constitutional requirements. Right? So the High Court has said that it's a constitutional requirement that you pass a bill, and European leaders are jumping up and down saying, get on with it, Europe. Sorry. That's what it says. And the other thing that the second part of the article says, any member state which decides to withdraw shall notify the European Council of its intentions in the light of guidelines provided by the European Council. In other words, they all get together and say what the guidelines should be. The Union shall negotiate and conclude an agreement with that state setting out its arrangements for its withdrawal, taking into account the framework for its future relationship. Now, administrators in the EU are saying you must do this bit first before you do that bit. But that's not what the article says. Well, maybe lawyers can find a way of getting around that. I'm just looking at over here, you know. But that's what it says. It says that you take it into account in relation to. So it suggests two sets of negotiations running in parallel. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist the joke. Maybe this, maybe that. May believes that migration control is absolutely key. And if you believe that, the only model actually must be the WTO model. And Britain with a low tariff policy, much like Hong Kong, Singapore. I mean, May and her colleagues are going around the world saying we must have free trade agreements. But I think notice has been served that free trade is no longer quite the thing it was yesterday. Not sure about that. Okay, but what I've put in here is there may be trouble ahead, but when there's music and moonlight and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. It is not Armageddon. Neither here nor in the United Kingdom. Life goes on. Prices change, opportunities change. But here are some of the problems. The three Brexiteers are out of their depth, it seems to me. There's the legal challenges, there's the challenge from the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and there's the Scottish woman who is really claiming that Scotland is like a federal entity, you know, a state within the United Kingdom. Well, it isn't. I can discuss that if you like later. The Brexiteers are adamant, Remainers are not willing to give up, and May's tough line in Cabinet is a little bit problematic. She's not yet learned to be a Prime Minister. She's still being a kind of Home Secretary heading towards being a Prime Minister. She will grow into that job. May's enemies are regrouping for parliamentary battle. At least 20 Conservative MPs are still strong from Remain. If Parliament proves awkward, she could call a general election, except the Parliament Act doesn't allow her to. She has to have a two-thirds majority. But, you know, if they refused, and she talks directly to the nation, you know, they're denying you the right for democratic appraisal and democratic change of government. I think they would change their mind. And anyway, they can't, because of the more than two-thirds of the English constituencies voted leave. So there's limits to what they can do. I said I'd introduce dear old Adam Smith. In 1776, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, and of course he was contemplating the loss of the American colonies. And what he said was, well, chums, don't worry about it. There's a lot of ruin in a nation. In other words, nations can absorb shocks. They can absorb shocks. And because Britain went on to develop a second empire and the Industrial Revolution and goodness knows what. So what he's basically saying is economies are just the shocks and that devastation is rare. And so people that are imagining a devastation. But we're approaching a huge change without significant technical understanding of the problems. So there's no easy way out, but the UK economy is much more flexible than any other economy in the European Union. That is a great advantage. So all I can say is, let's hope Adam Smith was right. Thank you very much. Is the open migration within Europe still continuing? The answer is yes. You've got to try and imagine what it's like. It doesn't affect me. You've got to try and imagine what it's like to living in a town that is not at the top of its game, where people, English people, who might have been of any ethnicity, are competing with people who turn up. During the height of this, 3,000 people could turn up in a small town, and where do you put them and what do you do with them and so on. So that the issues are about the consequences, also about cultural coherence. The re-emergence of high levels of public drunkenness because of certain immigrant communities. Although the British can't really complain about that because... not because of that. No, let me... You never know a story till you've heard the end. But if you go to Prague or you go to Wrocław, you'll see notices, no English men stag parties here, please, because they engage in massive amount of drunkenness. We've just got to be careful with these kinds of things. All I'm saying... No, they go, the English people go on their stag nights. I don't know what you call it here. What do you call it here? Sorry, not politically correct. Bachelor parties, and they just misbehave in a horrible way. So you've got to be careful with these sorts of arguments. But I'll just say something else. Immediately after the vote, people were accusing those people who voted to leave as being ignorant, racists, and so on. Well, I just quite frankly found that disgraceful. But the polite way of saying it was, populism. Right? Now, populism is not the fault of the people who populism is the result of a failure of the elite. It's a failure at a completely different level that gives rise to the problems. And good political leadership is about identifying these problems and lancing them before they become something horrible. The situation is this. Scotland, in the referendum, voted Remain. But the referendum was not about Scotland. The referendum question was, should the United Kingdom? Right? So in terms of the result of the referendum, they have to accept that. But the SNP, which is a minority government in Edinburgh, in the Scottish Parliament, is arguing that Scotland should remain in the European Union, as if it was some kind of already independent entity. Now, this clearly isn't going to happen. First of all, the United Kingdom is not going to agree. But even if it did agree, they would have to apply for it. She thinks that, Nicola Sturgeon thinks that somehow Scotland is a member of the European Union. Well, that's clearly nonsense. I mean, it's just not going to happen. But even if Scotland became independent, it would have to apply for membership of the European Union, and it'd have to go through a whole analytical process to which Spain would object, or Belgium, or Italy, because they all have significant areas of problems where, like the Catalans, who wish to have independence. And the European Union is not allowed to talk to regions independently. But when Nicola Sturgeon turned up in Brussels, she was met by Juncker. And the Spanish said, you should not have done that. And Tusk, the president of the council, refused to meet her. So there are all sorts of things in there. What I would say is that 80% of Scotland's exports go to England. They go to the rest of the United Kingdom. Probably the Republic of Ireland is in the same position. So the Irish are very worried about what is likely to happen if there is a hard... Oh, I forgot to mention hard Brexit and soft Brexit and clean and dirty and squidgy and I don't know. But, if you believe, and not everybody does, that world trade prices are a measure of value, you can get this resource produced cheaper somewhere else, then customs unions do two things. They divert trade away from a more efficient source to a less efficient source. But they also, if you're lucky, create trade. Trade between Poland and Britain is trade creation because Poland Poland would do very well on the international market if it without the EU, right? So you've got that. Now, if you've got that and you want the customs union, then the theory is have as big a customs union as possible. Because the bigger you have, the more diverse the economies are, the more likely you're going to have the beneficial effect of trade creation. Right. But that sits very, very uncomfortably with the idea of a federal United States of Europe. The two things are in conflict, completely in conflict. So I think there's a big conflict. And I did hear a rumour, but I don't like spreading rumours, but this one is probably not true, but it does make me chuckle. That the Germans are printing and stockpiling Deutschmarks
That wraps up Dr. William Henderson's lecture, The Brexit Revolutions. You can find this lecture in its entirety at kumd.org. Tonight's program was brought to you by the Allworth Institute for International Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth and by KUMD Duluth Public Radio. This episode was produced by Isaac Herman, Maya Jensen, and Cindy Christian. This lecture series is recorded Wednesday evenings at UMD and is free and open to the public.